I declare the meeting open at 5:30 PM. I welcome councillors, management and members of the public in attendance to the City of Melbourne. We respectfully acknowledge that we are meeting on the traditional land of the Kulin Nation. This place is now known by the name of Melbourne. Melbourne is one of the great multicultural cities of the world and a significant meeting place. For the Kulin Nation, Melbourne has always been an important meeting place and a location for events of social, educational, sporting and cultural significance. I take this opportunity to notify members of the public the meeting is being recorded and will be made available on the City of Melbourne website before close of business tomorrow. The unconfirmed minutes of the meeting will also be available from the City of Melbourne's website as soon as practicable. Should there be any queries relating to the conduct of the meeting, the documentation or the submission process, please speak with a member of the Council business team after the meeting. May I ask that all mobile phones be turned off for the duration of the meeting? The agenda comprises 7 reports from management, none of which are confidential, 2 items of general business. Apologies have been received from Councillors Foster and Pinder Mortimer. And could I ask if any councillor has a direct or indirect conflict of interest as defined in the Local Government Act 1989 in relation to a matter to be considered by committee, please disclose the type and the nature of the interest prior to consideration of the item. Could I call on a councillor to move a resolution adopting the minutes of open meeting number 22 held on Tuesday the 8th of October 2013? Councillor Wood, thank you. Deputy Lord Mayor, I'll put that motion. All those in favour? That's carried unanimously. Thank you. Are there any matters arising from the minutes of the previous meeting? In that case, in accordance with the Council resolution of the 26th of March 2013, a 15-minute period is provided at the beginning and the end of the meeting for members of the public to ask questions. Questions cannot be greater than 90 seconds in duration. I now invite questions from members of the public, and I note that Dr. John Price has advised that he would like to ask the committee a question. Is there anybody else who'd like to ask us a question? Sure. Thanks, Peter. Could I call on John Price first, please?
My question to the Lord Mayor is as follows. On the 31st of October 2013, you and the Dr. Napthine announced that an application will be made for the Queen Victoria Market Precinct to be listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Now, naturally, of course, that is a very highly demanding request. Sale of parts of the precinct, demolition of old buildings, building rerouting of roads, which would involve foundations, building of underground car parks, which involve entry ramps and exit ramps and ventilation shafts, could be in violation of the intent of the UNESCO operational guidelines, the implementation of the World Heritage Convention. Could you please inform us as to the process proposed to make the application to UNESCO, in particular from a correspondence we had yesterday, making note that you have to make this application before you do the damaging activities listed above? And can you confirm that a proposal has been prepared for public comment on the future of the market, which conforms with the intent of preserving the precinct to conform with the UNESCO operational guidelines?
Thank you, John. Can I answer those in the detail I can give you at the moment? You are quite right, they are very exacting provisions, and the first stage would be to apply for national heritage listing. I'd also point out that it is a process under the guidance of the federal government. It is only the federal government who can provide that national listing and, in fact, make application for the UNESCO listing as well. I have had very preliminary discussions with the new minister responsible, the Honourable Greg Hunt. He has indicated the willingness of the federal government to work with us on the preparation of the documentation that's required for national listing as a first stage before we go to UNESCO. You are quite right, although I would make the point that the way you phrased a number of those things is rather pessimistic and negative. The intent of applying for that listing is exactly the opposite. You say these things could be deleterious to such a listing. The intention is that the work that we will do at the Queen Victoria Market will not in any way hamper the application for UNESCO World Heritage listing. That doesn't mean we will be successful either at national level or at UNESCO level. I would point out, however, that the listing will depend, yes, on the things that you have put forward, but they're the things that may stop you. What will get you across the line is the respect for the heritage buildings, but equally, and very importantly in this case, for instance, compared to the exhibition buildings, the use of the site as a market and its reflection, therefore, of its heritage values for the city. It is not our intention to fail in this listing for the Queen Victoria Market. It is our intention to succeed. And before we've even started the process of asking the public about the areas of the market and what we should do, that needs to be borne in mind, as you quite properly point out, because it has to be borne in mind from the very start of the process, not during it or at the end of it. And that is our intention here at the city, to work our way through with the public before there's even been anything more, to be honest, than an announcement from the Premier and myself to make sure we get it right. But the intention is to get it right, and I hope to get that listing to protect the market forever. Thank you. Peter.
My name is Peter Collier. I'm an owner of an apartment at 25 Hotham Street, East Melbourne, and I'm representing the Owners Corporation, who have had their parking permits, which they had from the day they purchased their units, withdrawn by the Director of City Planning and Infrastructure. And my question is this. Does the Melbourne City Council have a plan to compensate the owners at 25 Hotham Street for financial loss, to redress those residents disadvantaged and discriminated against, and to compensate residents when injured when walking long distances as a result of the withdrawal of these parking permits?
Peter, I'll defer to my manager of planning in a moment. Could you answer for us, is it not the case in this development, have I got the right one, where you were informed from the start that you had no right to such planning permits?
There is a section in the contract of sale, but at the same time, people weren't necessarily informed at the time.
But hang on, Peter. But what you are telling me, it was in their contract of sale that they had no parking permits.
Yes, but what I'm telling to you is that the council from day one issued parking permits, and people bought units with the knowledge that permits were being issued.
Oh, hang on. No. I'm sorry. I'm going to take planning advice and then legal advice on this, because that is not in the correct order. And I can promise you we looked at this very closely. Could I have someone from planning, please, perhaps our director, to inform us what the state of play is here? Jeff, thank you.
Lord Mayor and councillors, when the council issued its planning approval for the development of the property in question, it put in that planning approval a condition that the occupants of the buildings would not be able to access the on-street resident parking priority scheme. It also put in a condition that should be further tightened through the creation of a Section 173 agreement under the Planning and Environment Act, which effectively became a covenant on the title. The expectation at that time, as is normal case, that in the discovery of documents associated with property when people were purchasing, that they would discover that contract as being affixed to the title, or that agreement as being affixed to the title. However, another part of the organisation which administers the resident parking permit priority permits did not take that into account in their operation of the system, and did for a period of time issue permits, albeit in contradiction of the council's decision some time previous to that. This was discovered as a result of complaints from other people in the area, not people who are living at the property, and it was discovered that these permits had indeed been issued incorrectly. In order to give people time to adjust to that, it was decided to allow a further 12 months, after which they would not be further issued. And in answer to Mr. Collier's question, no, there is no intention to provide compensation.
Is there any legal basis upon which the residents of this development can claim to have parking permit status?
Perhaps I might defer to Kim Wood to answer that, given that you're asking a legal question. Lord Mayor.
The situation is the owners and occupiers are not entitled to resident parking permits. The fact that they received resident parking permits for a period of time is a benefit that they weren't entitled to, but they got it. Does that change the fact they're not entitled to them in the future? I don't think so. I mean, my view on this is they weren't entitled. Their title says that they're not entitled. They received a benefit that they weren't entitled to. They're lucky. But that doesn't change the fact that in the future that they don't have an entitlement. I don't see they've got a basis to make a claim.
Thank you.
Can I say something further?
Peter, it's not a debate, sorry.
No,
it's a chance to ask us a question. And you have done so, and I think you now have the answer from our officers.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions that people would like to ask of us? Thank you. In that case, at 3 p.m. today, the following submissions were received in accordance with the Council's Conduct of Meetings Local Law 2010. In relation to Agenda Item 6.1, submissions on the Fisherman's Bend Urban Renewal Area Draft Vision, a request to speak from Sean McCarthy. As at 3 p.m. today, more than 30 written submissions were received in conjunction with this agenda item. In relation to Agenda Item 7.2, Notice of Motion from Councillor Oak, St Petersburg Relationship, requests to speak from Carl Catter, Brett Hayo and Corey Earlham, and an item of correspondence from Dr Philip and Tipper. Is there anybody here who would like to address us whose name I have not read out? Thank you. I advise submitters that you have 3 minutes to address the committee. We adhere to the 3 minute time limit, and there is a counter on the wall behind us to help you there. Beep sound at the completion of 2 minutes, and then there is a final beep to signal the time allocated to you has concluded. Could I advise members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than 6 members voting in favour of it, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. Could I call on Councillor Ong to assume the role of chair in relation to the planning portfolio?
Thank you, Lord Mayor. There's one report from management for consideration under the planning portfolio tonight. Agenda item 6.1, submission on the Fisherman's Bend Urban Renewal Area Draft Vision. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? If not, I call on Sean McCarthy, resident who requested to address the committee. Sean, you have 3 minutes.
My name is Sean McCarthy. I'm a resident of Yarra's Edge, and I'm here to strongly object to what I see from the recently published Fisherman's Bend Urban Renewal Area Draft Vision is a plan to decimate the community at Yarra's Edge by building a low bridge between the two only open green spaces that exist there, one of which is the Collins Landing site, the other is Point Park. So am I being dramatic in using emotive language like destroy? Well, let's consider what's being proposed. As far as I understand it, the proposal is a tram or a light railway bridge that would by necessity be very low and would preclude almost all the boats that use the current marina at Yarra's Edge from going there. At one fell stroke, this would undo much of the work that's been done in the last 10 years to integrate the CBD with the waterside. The marina is very heart and soul of Yarra's Edge, not only for residents, but also for visitors. I get a lot of overseas visitors from other parts of Melbourne, from interstate, And their reaction is normally pleasant surprise at the spirit which has been shown in engineering such a striking renewal program so close to the CBD. I heard about the proposed bridge back in early 2013, and my reaction, honestly, was one of disbelief. I was certain that I was being given false or alarmist information. I reasoned that no planning authority would be crass enough to choke off what's already become an iconic part of the new Melbourne. The residents of Yarra's Edge and the overwhelming majority of visitors are totally against what's being proposed. And here are some of the things that they talk about. The marina will disappear, almost certainly. The Point Park will be destroyed. The trams that were going to run so close to towers 6 and 8 will be create so much noise it will be very difficult for people that purchase in good faith. Remember, they didn't know that there was going to be a tram route going past their front windows. It would be unacceptable for them. Open use of the Yarra will be severely curtailed. A vibrant community will be destroyed and property values will be adversely affected. In fact, the whole ethos of the Docklands renewal will be severely compromised. Anyone who's interested in hearing about these views can go down there and talk to people. The overwhelming reaction of all the residents, almost all the residents of Yarra Ridge, is very negative. Most people understand that a city as dynamic as Melbourne has to have urban renewal plans close to the CBD. But we fail to understand why this has to be done at the expense of what's already been achieved at Yarra's Edge. Everyone has their ideas about what other alternatives there are, and it doesn't take a genius to realise that there are other ways that the future residents of Yarra's Edge could actually get there.
Sean, yes? time's up. We do have all the submissions, so we understand where you're coming from.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone want questions for Sean yet? Nope. Okay, in that case, before I call the council to move a motion that's up on the board with some changes from the original, can I ask Jeff Lawler, our Director of City Planning, whose area is responsible for this report, that the change to the heading on page 3, does it has any impact on the report's intention?
Jeff can't comment on something that's not before us, and that's actually not before us until it's moved. You can ask him to make general comments, but you can't ask him to comment on something that has not actually been put before council.
All right. In that case, I will ask the councillor to move the motion on the board.
Yeah, I'll move the motion on the board. I won't speak to the changes now. I'll ask the councillor to speak to it.
Thank you, Councillor Wood. Councillor Wood, ask the councillor to second the motion.
Happy to second it.
Yes, Lord Mayor, second it.
Thank you, Chair.
Councillor Wood.
So, Sean, your points are well made. The marina there is a bustling hive of activity. One of the things that we want to ensure with this I guess shiny new part of our municipality and indeed City of Port Phillip is that we don't want to have adverse impacts on what is already a thriving area for residents. The other thing that we don't want to do with this connection, which is a really important connection, is we don't want to sort of give precedence to another form of transport and adversely impact what is already an important form of transport, whether that be recreationally or whether that be commercial or commuter. So City of Melbourne's been pretty vocal in terms of its support for things like the water taxis up and down the Yarra. So keeping that is really important. So you'll see the addition there is really about protecting that ability to get from the harbour into the Yarra precinct. And that's a key part of this revision. The thing it doesn't touch on, obviously, is the loss of open space. I do note, however, that the submission by officers does really touch on open space being an important facet of the Fisherman's Bend redevelopment. So although it doesn't answer all of your issues, Sean, it does answer one of the major ones, and that is that what we would need to see there with that Yarra River Bridge extension is, you know, it would need to be something in the order that's probably operable. You know, whether that's a cantilever bridge that opens at certain times, whether it swings, there's all sorts of different designs around the world that that we can take from. The other point I guess we should make too is that this is a submission to a Places Victoria plan that's being sought by the Minister, so there's still a long way to go in terms of comment around this design overlay, so there's still a lot of room for input both from residences, from businesses and also from the city itself. So I hope that this amended motion actually goes some way to addressing the concerns of those over 30 submitters. Obviously, there's further concerns there that will need to be addressed in other ways, but obviously open space strategy that the City of Melbourne's got is very important to us, and we've identified Docklands as being one of those areas that needs further open space.
Lord Mayor.
Thank you. I'll just add, I agree with everything Councillor Wood has said. I agree with what our submitter said, and I think that the people who have written to us and come to see us have a very good point. And I must say, when I looked at it just as a map, perhaps it was because we were looking at a map of public transport and then separately a map of the waterways and not understanding what the overlay on one to the other would mean, particularly for this marina, has meant that we've overlooked something that's very obvious, that we do not want to in any way impede access to the marina at Yarra's Edge and upstream traffic. So I think that this amendment, in fact, I'm confident that this amendment allows us to explore other options for necessary public transport links. Now, whether those other options are a realignment along the so-called Lorimer route or a cantilever design of the bridge itself, as Councillor Wood has said, understanding that that may or may not solve the noise problem that our submitter raised, or whether there are other design possibilities that meet the requirements of keeping that very important ambience of the area that has been so hard won over the last 10 years, I'm confident that this amendment will allow us to do it and to continue to work with the submitters, the wider community and Places Victoria to get what we want for Fisherman's Bend, including connections to our city, while not in any way impeding on the lifestyle or the ambience of a wonderful area of the city.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Any other councillors like to speak to the motion? Councillor Main.
I just like to commend the officers for their work on this report. I think to understand the history, I think the Minister took a liking to Fisherman's Bend as something that he could put his stamp on and dramatically loosened the planning controls before we really had laid out a strategic plan. And we had a dramatic increase in property valuations and a flood of applications without a broad strategic framework. So I think it was a good catch-up football by Places Vic and many of our officers in then, retrospectively almost, coming up with the Places Vic proposal, which we, I know, had a substantial input into. So in a curious sort of way, we are submitting to our own report. And I think that that's a good place for us to be in that we've been involved at the strategic level, which is perhaps what didn't happen at Docklands. So we have gone to school on some of the Docklands errors, and I think it's a good submission. It's good to take on board the concerns around the bridge and the Yarra's Edge residents and the marina. But well done for the bigger picture of handling growth in Melbourne, 80,000 people a year, when the government's vision is to lock down many of the old neighbourhood zones and not necessarily grow the urban growth boundary. The designated growth areas are really going to have to do a lot of the hard work. So when you talk about 80,000 residents, 40,000 workers in Fisherman's Bends, with the current planning vision of the government, then these growth areas are really going to be intensely developed. And so when that happens, you've got to get the overall strategic framework right. And well done to, I think, Rob Adams, Rob Moore, David Mays and Leanne Hoddle, I think, are the officers who've probably had the most amount of input, and I think they've done well. They've put the Melbourne position strongly, and I think it's reflected in the quality of the framework that we now have before us.
Thank you, Councillor Mann. Councillor Oak.
Thank you, Chair. I support the recommendation. I concur with Councillor Mann and thank the officers for their submission, and I think that their recommendations for major changes I think are incredibly important, that whilst there are a lot of... it is a strategic vision, but it's identified the need to be quite specific on a lot of indicators, in particular around the health and wellbeing of this new community, and that it's all very well to talk about livable neighbourhoods, but what does that actually mean? And around... indicators such as, or not indicators, but criteria around sustainability, open space, as Councillor Wood has mentioned, and other measures around community infrastructure and facilities. We don't want to be retrofitting Fisherman's Bend, not only with community services, but we don't want to be retrofitting it with sustainability options either, and getting in early and putting in the precinct-wide renewable energy or water-sensitive urban design is incredibly important, as is getting in and making sure that the facilities are there for the community when they move in, and not retrospectively as well. I know a lot of those things come with the new community, but we need to make sure there's a base level as well. Importantly, as all speakers have spoken about, transport connections are important, and the report does indicate the concern that residents have raised to us in the many submissions, and thank you for the submissions over the last few weeks from Yarra's Edge. The report, our submission, does mention that concern, and it does talk about looking at alternative design options, but the wording that Councillor Wood has put forward, I think, just strengthens that and strengthens the wording to acknowledge that we've heard the residents, that it's not about just looking at design options, it's actually making sure that it doesn't impede access to Port Phillip Bay and to the river and to Yarra's Edge residents. I support the recommendation.
Sorry, there's no questions from the floor.
I support the recommendation, and I believe that officers will continue to support and work with the state government on developing this important renewal area for Melbourne.
Thank you. Mr. McCarthy, if you have further questions, at the end of the meeting, there's another opportunity for you to ask questions, but you'll have to wait to the rest of the agenda, okay? Now, I'll just make my comment before I ask the mover to... Can I make first? Okay, thank you. I think Lord Mayor and fellow councillors have made some comments. I've been involved with this particular project from the beginning when it was first mooted with Places Victoria, the City of Port Phillip, and the City of Melbourne together with Places together with DPCD, Department of Transport, and a whole lot of other government departments. And I have to acknowledge that a lot of the work that's put into the PCG or the Project Control Group is actually by the Director of City Planning, Mr. Jeff Lawler, who has attended every single one of those meetings and who has got, organized that the City of Melbourne's planners and strategic planners and urban designers have their appropriate input. And that's very important. One comment I would also like to make is which might contradict one of my fellow councillors, is that when this was first announced more than 18 months ago as a renewal area, a lot of developers jumped the gun because they assumed that there will be very, very open-ended planning guidelines. And some of them are complaining about it now because this particular strategic plan's come out and it shows clear interfaces between low-rise, residential, mid-rise, to high rise in certain areas, and the open space and the requirements for schools, transport links, walking infrastructure, bicycle infrastructure. So it's actually a lot of work put in by a lot of very, very capable and knowledgeable people to come up with this. Of course, when it first came out, there are issues, there are questions and issues that still to be sorted out, and especially in Yarra's Edge. And I take on board that there is a real concern.
I was talking to officers and engineers. The bridge design is flexible because anything can be done in today's technologies. I think that's one thing to consider and hope that the solution they come up with, this particular further investigation of the design options, will come up with something that's respectful of the current users and also respectful that the strategic aim of Fisherman's Bend does require transport links. Otherwise, we'll have more gridlock from traffic. Because the whole situation, as we can see, this particular Fisherman's Bend strategy needs to be read in conjunction with the Plan Melbourne document that's been released 3 weeks ago. It talks about a bigger picture of growth and how it all needs to fit together. So I just commend all the work that's been done, and I also thank the residents for bringing attention to a particular issue that concerns them deeply. And I just hope that the submission that we're putting in to Places Victoria will be taken on board and will get an outcome to address this particular issue and the open space issue. But I'm quite sure that from the work they've been doing together with Port Phillip and with Places Victoria, I'm quite sure we can get a very good outcome. Councillor Leppard, you'd like to say a few words.
Thank you, Chair. Look, I won't add to what already has been said. I'll just comment on something else, and that is just the community perception of urban renewal programs in Melbourne at the moment. I think, look, Councillor Mayne's quite right that the process began a little bit shakily, and this is more about the Minister being seen to be taking big steps very quickly than necessarily wanting to make sure that the community was all on board with what steps were going to be taken. I'll comment why I don't think we've arrived at a bad outcome first, but I do think that given the recent controversies in planning in Victoria, that this could have been an opportunity to do more, to cooperate between planning authorities. You know, Melbourne Council can be a planning authority. It isn't in this case. And the state government, the minister can be a planning authority. Places Victoria's got the role to prepare the documentation here. But if we could have demonstrated to the public that there was a lot of cooperation between these bodies and a lot more community input, I suspect that we'd have an even better draft vision in front of us to look at today than we do. As other councillors have said, it's not a bad draft vision. But I'm very nervous about the community perception. The very quick and enormous expansion of the capital city zone over the entire Fisherman's Bend area is, of course, something that makes a lot of people nervous, including myself. In some respects, I think the plan could have been bolder. I note that the earlier drafts, which councillors were privileged to see, were a bit different. I won't comment on what's in any of those, of course. I think that if we're going to talk about future rail network expansions, we could have done more than just say where potential stations could have gone. Corridors need to be mapped out, and if we're going to do proper planning for future public transport, then more could have been done. But these are just some examples. As other councillors have said, I think the starting principles here are better than some of the starting principles for the Docklands urban renewal area, for example. So with all of those comments in mind, and without implicitly wanting to state that I overwhelmingly support the draft vision, I think that the submission made by officers is a great improvement, and of course that's the only question in front of us today. Do we support that submission? And I do. And I hope that the project can continue with more community awareness of what's planned and more community input into how that vision can be realised than perhaps otherwise might be the case. And if so, we could have a very exciting precinct in Fisherman's Bend.
Thank you, Councillor Leppard. But Councillor Wood, would you like to close this debate?
Yeah, just as briefly as I can be, I think the point's well made that whether it's a bridge or whether it's a realignment, as the Lord Mayor noted, this is very early days. As other councillors have mentioned, it is great to actually have a vision. It is quite a good document. It's a great basis to start from. City of Melbourne's submission is excellent and should only serve to enhance that vision document, but there's still a long way to go in terms of submissions from residents. It's been great to have over 30 submitters to tonight's process. All of that has added value.
and has resulted essentially in the motion that's before us at the moment. I'm going to do something on the run a little bit. I've had a quick conversation with the Chair of Transport, and we'll put our hands up, Chair of Transport and Chair of Environment. We'll invite Chair of Planning along as well, because this sits firmly in his area. But to come down and have a chat with those submitters about what we can do at Yarra's Edge to further input into this vision document.
Thank you, Councillor Wood. On that note, are there any speakers against the motion? Okay. I put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Lord Mayor, other than the two councillors not here, it's a unanimous. Yes. I now call on Councillor Wood to assume the role of chair in a meeting in relation to the environment portfolio.
Thank you very much, Councillor Ong. There's one report from management for consideration under the environment portfolio. Agenda item 6.2, the Urban Forest Precinct Plans 2013 for East Melbourne and Jolimont, Carlton, Central City and South Yarra. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? No. I would like to move the motion that's on the screen. Can I get a seconder for that motion? Second, Councillor Oak. So the precinct plans are essentially the next level down from our urban forest strategy, where we want to double canopy cover over the next 20 years. But I guess this is where we really sort of the rubber hits the road, and we get a lot of resident input in terms of what they want their streetscape to look like. We should mention that over the last year, 3 years, we've spent $30 million beyond business as usual on supporting this type of planning through stormwater harvesting, porous paving and many other different initiatives. The annual tree planting budget is not a small one. We're talking in the order of $4 million, so this is not small change to achieve the vision that we're looking to achieve. But the streetscapes of Melbourne are extremely important, both for amenity but also for reducing the urban heat island effect. And really, they do determine exactly the status of Melbourne as a beautiful city right across the world. So we've got 70,000 trees across the municipality that the City of Melbourne manages, our streets, our parks and gardens, but there's also 20,000 trees in the private landscape as well. So it's about integrating with those private spaces. The actual amenity value of our trees is up over $700 million. So we're not talking, again, small change, and that's just replacement value alone. It doesn't talk about all the other services that our trees provide. So the precinct plans, I've got one of them in front of me, the draft plan, heavy consultation with community members right down to street level, talking about, specific streetscapes, what type of species, what type of genus, what did people want to get from their streets and their street trees. I think one of the most enjoyable things, and these were often on a Sunday morning, so that's a pretty tough thing to be getting out of bed on a Sunday morning when you could be relaxing, but to go along and have, over 100 community members turn up to one of these precinct planning sessions shows just how much City of Melbourne residents actually value their trees. So their input has been fantastic. And we'll only continue as we roll out these precinct plans. So I absolutely commend the work that officers have done. The team has put in an amazing amount of work. And I remember one resident just noted that it was great to see the level of importance that was put on the consultation process for this very important part of our city. So absolutely commend these precinct plans. Councillor Oak.
Thank you, Councillor Wood. It's exciting to see the precinct plans being developed. Having been involved in the development of the urban forest strategy and the principles that underpin these precinct plans, and seeing them in action effectively, and taking part in the engagement process, not only about the principles and the urban forest strategy, but also the community, the consultation plans for these precincts, it's been great to see how people are involved in our trees in Melbourne. And Councillor Wood mentioned the amenity value of our trees, and that doesn't actually capture the social health and wellbeing costs or benefits of the trees that they provide to the community. But you can see the emotional response that trees provide when you attend these meetings, and people are really, they have their very strong opinions about the trees that they want in their streets. And I think one of the important things about these processes when we're in community, we're presenting the principles that I mentioned before, the reasons why the criteria that we need to follow if we want to double the canopy by 2040. We need to select particular species, we need them to be resilient, robust, and we need them to provide a lot of things for our city to ensure this doubling of canopy and the diversity that we seek. But it's important that then the trees that we select within those criteria meet the needs of the community, and that they respond to the cultural needs, that the needs of young people, families, and people who've lived in these suburbs for a long time, and new communities as well. And it was just great to see the interactions of people around the tables, within streets, within the suburbs that we've spoken with. And it was great to see the interaction across the diverse communities around the trees that they like. And now they'll be able to see it in action. So they'll be able to see that the trees that they wanted being planted in their streets, and that's going to be exciting to see and hopefully receive feedback on as well. And the report that we're looking at, it documents all of the comments and all of that colour and flavour and joy, I think, that people found throughout the process, that it really does document their comments and their concerns, and I really commend the officers, and I know that a few of them are here tonight, and in particular Yvonne Lynch and Ian Shears, who's not here tonight, but they've spent a lot of time on this strategy and a lot of time on the community consultation, and we've won awards as a result, and that should be acknowledged as well. So I commend the precinct plans, and I look forward to seeing them being rolled out and making it a cooler and city and more adapted for the changing climate ahead of us.
Thanks, Councillor Oak. Any other speakers for the motion? Any speakers against the motion? I'll put that to the vote. All those who love trees, that's passed unanimously. I now call on Councillor Watts to assume the role of Chair of the meeting in relation to the People's City portfolio.
Thank you. There are two reports from management for consideration under the People's City portfolio tonight. Agenda item 6.3, We Need to Talk, Preventing Violence Against Women Strategy 2013-16. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? No. I call upon a councillor to move the motion before you. Deputy Lord Mayor, a seconder? Yes, I'll second the motion. Would the mover like to speak to the motion?
Thank you, Councillor Watts. Yes, look, I do support this. I think we've come a long way in preventing violence against women, but we still have a long way to go. So a strategy like this just takes it all in, and what can a city do to help get this message across? And this is exactly what our thoughts are with this particular strategy.
Thank you. Would anyone else? I'd like to speak to it then as a seconder to this motion. It seems to me that it's been one that's been developed very well. I can see here, there were 679 visits to the Participate Melbourne Preventing Violence Against Women project page, and 8 visitors responded to the survey. Now, none of this might seem earth-shattering numbers, but when you consider the topic and you consider the pain that's associated with it, I think it's a very good response. So I think that this work is very important. The aspect of safety in our city runs across many portfolios, and the safer city we get, the better from many points of view. So this is a very good thing indeed. Now, are there any other speakers for the motion? Okay. Councillor Oak?
Thank you, Councillor Watts. Thank officers for preparing this strategy. It's not an issue that you like to read about, and it does, as Councillor Watt says, it does cover and come out of other strategies that we have, a safe city strategy and our homelessness strategy, and I think that and also in our council plan, we've made it a priority to support the prevention of violence against women. And the ideas that have been put forward in this strategy are good, and I really hope that they're successful and we can reduce the numbers. I think looking at our workforce is an important element of the strategy when you look at the numbers of women who are affected by violence. Sorry, it's not a good topic. And you look at our workforce and the number of people in our workforce, obviously there are not women in our organisation who are affected. And, sorry, I'm really tired at the moment. And it's wired, yes. But it is important to acknowledge that obviously within the numbers of staff that we have, there are obviously women in our organisation that are affected by violence, and we need to look at what we're doing here to address the issue as well and provide the support. And I think the strategy really does identify how we can do that. I'm so tired.
Thank you. Are there any speakers against the motion? Oh, another speaker for the motion. Thank you, Lord Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor. I think this is a very good piece of work to complement our role as a white ribbon city. I think that we need to acknowledge, as this report does, this is a problem of men. And I think we need to, in the words of the Herald Sun, take a stand. I would point out, and I'm not going to add to what previous speakers have said or what the report says, but there is a kind of normative deviance. If men put up with a low level of aggression against women, then that becomes the norm and the standard of deviation rises higher again. And so, as the Chief of Army made very plain in his YouTube posting to all members of his organisation, the behaviour you walk past is the behaviour you are prepared to accept. And this report challenges us not to walk past any behaviour which is in any way violent or aggressive towards women. And the lower the level at which we can deal with it, the more appropriate will be our final cultural response. So I support this as well, of course. I think, though, that while reports are one thing, it is important that we as men work out that even in our most everyday interactions, we need to live this and make sure that we do stand up against any aggression in whatever form against anybody really, but in this case particularly, of course, against women. The final point I'll make is rather a pessimistic one. For probably 5 or 6 years, cities around the world, including ourselves, have focused on crime and have focused on safety in our streets. And notwithstanding some terrible incidents that we've had in our recent history, we are kind of winning that battle. Assaults against the person are down. Violence in the city is down. The one area that is climbing, and by the way, this is not just Melbourne, this is cities around Australia, and I've met recently with the Lord Mayors of every capital city, and cities around the world, as detailed by Mayor Johnson from London when he was here. The one area that is escalating is domestic violence, particularly against women, and also being one of the major causes of homelessness. So this to me is a seamless piece of work that doesn't try to overstep the bounds of what a city can do, but nevertheless recognises there is an important role for the city to play in taking a stand against violence against women.
Thank you. Councillor Ong.
Thank you, Councillor Watts. I'd like to support what the Lord Mayor has said, and the Lord Mayor has been sort of shy to mention that he is our City of Melbourne's White Ribbon Ambassador. And many of us, councillors current and past, have always signed the support for the White Ribbon Foundation and what it does. I think one of the most important aspect of this particular report and strategy is to take it out to the communities. We just don't need to publish the report and then we forget about it. The important thing is to take it out to the communities. One of the great things about this city is that it's such a diverse and multicultural city. And of course, with that comes its own challenges. And one of the key things is to make sure that when we get this out there, we need to support it with good communication education across all the communities to understand this is how we expect our communities to behave and to respect women. I think that's that will be itself. It's a sensitive area, but I believe that we need to take that challenge on board
and make sure it gets through all the services and agencies we work with within the city and beyond.
Councillor Wood.
Yeah, just following on from the Lord Mayor's point about this violence happening behind closed doors, and it's one of those difficult ones because you can't just stick a bouncer on the door or have more police on the beat to solve this one. And really, the only way you solve it is by not accepting it, as the Lord Mayor rightly said. The other sad thing about this is that often children are involved, and so this is really about breaking a cycle, because it's a cycle that just keeps on perpetuating for generation after generation. Lord Mayor was right to say that this is not a problem which is restricted to City of Melbourne by any means. Once you get out into the regional areas like my old hometown of Mildura, domestic abuse is well and truly exceeding every other crime, and often exceeding every other crime in total when added together with every other crime. So this is almost of epidemic proportions. It's a pretty sad blight on such a lucky and happy country. And it really does start with us saying that we accept it no longer and breaking that cycle. So I fully commend this strategy and the fact that its whole premise is about the fact we need to talk. And that means getting it out there, and that means it means telling your mates, it means telling the people you know that you no longer accept this type of thing.
Thank you. Any other councillors? No, nobody will speak against this motion. So let's put the motion to the vote. All those in favour of the motion, please raise your hand. The motion is carried unanimously. So moving on to the next item, agenda item 6.4, community funding policy and neighbourhood house policy review. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? Apparently not. So I call upon a councillor to move the motion. Thank you, Councillor Lippert. Yes. Actually, there's a bit of a glitch here with the process. There is a new version of this that changes the wording slightly. So I thought it would be on the screen already, but may I say that it... Thank you. The motion on the screen, as you see, has been altered slightly. Councillor Leppard, you still happy with this? Very well, I'll move that motion. Would someone second that? For?
I will.
Thank you, Councillor Oak. So, I'd like to speak to the motion. It seems to me to be a very important piece of work that moves us to have the community sector grants and funding policy align more closely with other reforms and other reviews that we've had in other kinds of funding within our city. The reason we're delaying the actual carriage of this motion to the council meeting is to allow councillors a little more time to have a very close look at what it is. In essence, it's a very good piece of work. There are some elements in it which I would like clarified and would like to be discussed with the relevant officers. And I think the chair of this portfolio may wish to do that also. And given that he isn't here with us tonight, he will have time before it reaches council. So this just gives a little bit of breathing room to reflect a little more closely on what is essentially a good piece of work. I think it's important that the City of Melbourne review the way in which its grants and its funding policies roll out, and so this is consistent with that. So would the second like to speak?
Thank you, Councillor Watts. I was going to support the original recommendation from Councillor Leppard and I would have been happy to pass this strategy tonight, but I understand that the Chair... the current chair and the chair that's not here at the moment may seek to just have a little bit more time, and so I support the recommendation that we seek council's endorsement of the community funding policy. My reading of the policy document is that it has taken there's a lot of information in there, and we've learned a lot of lessons around how we fund long-term partners, as well as various what the neighbourhood house policy may or may not be. I believe that the policy in front of us is a good one, and looks at a more strategic approach, and I think that it should work, but I understand that there might be a few more changes come council meeting.
Thank you. Would any other councillor like to speak? Lord Mayor?
Thank you. I too think this is a good piece of policy work. It's certainly headed in the right direction. What I would like before we see it at council is some further information about how this is not the same, but how is it consistent with our approach, for instance, to arts and culture grants and to events grants. This is the community funding round, but nevertheless, what are the templates that can be used across all, so that we're presenting a consistent approach where that is possible, because it's not always possible. And secondly, I think I need to understand not just across the nature of the grant, arts and culture versus events versus community funding, but across the type of grants we're making. Are these competitive? Are they iterative, long-term, medium-term, short-term? Are they so-called strategic partnerships? What does that mean as a strategic partnership, for instance, with a neighbourhood house, as against the relationship we have in triennial funding in the arts for the big festivals? Now, they may not be able to be mapped entirely over each other, but that would be useful so that we do have a sense of consistency of approach and terminology in particular. And finally, of course, that we are consistent in the way that we measure the outcomes and the outputs of these grants, and we acquit the grants once that they have been used by the agency taking them up. Apart from that, which I think is really a desktop mapping exercise, you know, with various parts of the city looking at what's important to them, nevertheless, I am comfortable with the direction that this report presents to us.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to speak to this motion? No. Would anyone like to speak against this motion? No. So I would like to conclude by agreeing with the Lord Mayor that I think it's valuable to have some...
The only thing I would suggest is, do we, and I'll take advice on this from Mr. Williamson, do we need to put in there, recommend that council on, and I think we mean it to be considered on the 26th of November.
Mm. Should we insert that?
Is that
date
necessary, or?
Through you, Chair, that wouldn't be necessary. We would automatically refer it to the next available council.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, my final comment would be that I can see that if councillors find it valuable that there is some consistency in terminology, approach and evaluation of outcomes, I can see that constituents would feel that too. So anything we can do to clarify what we do to the wider community is a good thing. So I'll now put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Again, carried unanimously. Thank you. I'd like to now pass the... a call upon Councillor Mayne to assume the role of Chair of the meeting in relation to finance and governance portfolio.
There are three reports from management for consideration under the finance and governance portfolio. The first is agenda item 6.5, ratification of meeting dates 2014. I'd just like to move with a slight amendment to introduce the concept of a three-month winter recess, parliamentary style. No? Okay, so Councillor Ong is moved that I'll second it.
7 months recess,
yes. Yes. So, Councillor Ong, would you like to speak?
Looks busy next year.
Yeah, exactly the same as this year.
Sorry. And as the seconder, I'd like to say that there will be 22 FMC meetings next year, and combined with the 11 council meetings, that's 33 public discussions that occur. No other council in Australia that I'm aware of has 33 public full council meetings. So we are very open and transparent, and many councils get by with just one a month. And I think this is a very healthy thing that the community have an opportunity four times a month to come and ask public questions at the start or in the end of our future Melbourne committee meetings, and it's just great to have someone additional coming tonight because we don't usually get too many coming. So you can see that we're working hard over the next 12 months.
Are we just peeping up?
Different issue. Any other speakers on this motion? You're groaning there, Councillor Leffert. Would you like to speak? No? Okay. Councillor
Chair,
Ong? Okay.
The only reason no one ever challenges the assertions that this is the most transparent council that meets more often than any other council in Australia is because none of us can be bothered. If you really want to, I'm sure we can find an example. I support the motion.
All those in favour? Any against? Declare that motion carried. Agenda item 6.6 is the 2013-14 first quarter September financial report. Would councillors like a presentation?
Can I ask a question, Chair?
Councillor Ong to ask a question.
Question to, I guess, to Fu. In the key issues there, number 7, reading that, it says quarter to 30 September result additional revenue of 2.16 million year to date. And supplementary valuations are 2.69 against a full year budget of 1.97. Can you explain that a bit? Because I'm somewhat confused by that statement.
Sure, Councillor. Through you, Chair. The $2.16 million year to date is the actual amount of supplementary valuations that have been received during the quarter. The supplementary valuations of 2.69 is the full year budget, and the $1.97 million is a net figure in terms of net rates. The reason for the difference is that we've got obviously objections included in the net figure. So that's the difference between the three figures quoted in the report.
Any other questions, councillors, for food? Okay, thanks, Phil. I'm happy to move the motion on the screen. Do we have a seconder? The Lord Mayor. Okay, well, the quarterly financials are show a healthy perspective. We're an underlying budget surplus of 14.4 million, which is about 5 million ahead of the projected 8.82 million. The reasons for that, the biggest one is that we've underspent our wages budget by a couple of million because we've been resolving our EBA, so there will be a back payment. So that's simply a timing issue. Parking revenue and both fees and fines are both about 300,000 ahead of budget after the first quarter. So I think it's fair to say that the usage of our parking meters after a very substantial increase has not fallen perhaps as much as it might have in terms of utilisation. And it's good to see that after some years of revenue holes, I think we were 8 million short in fines last year, that we've got our estimates right, and we're doing a little bit better than we had estimated. Probably the most troubling element is the $1.6 million under budget in terms of contributions from subsidiaries, and the report does very specifically say that Citywide has significantly not met its budget. So we need to keep an eye on Citywide, which is a very large subsidiary of ours with a national footprint in services, that hopefully will claw back some of that over the balance of the year. We sold off a lane, Benson's Lane, which contributed to being almost 900,000 ahead of budget in terms of asset sales. Interestingly, we can do that under delegation. We don't, through a council, make decisions on small-scale property sales like that. A million ahead of budget on open space. And obviously the building industry is going well. When you're 400,000 ahead of budget on building fees, that is an indicator of the fact that activity is strong in the city. For new construction. Overall, our cash is down to 84.3 million, which is probably a 20-year low or close ever since we received the 230 million from the sale of the electricity business in the mid-1990s. But let's put that into perspective. I was talking to a councillor from Cardinia Shire last week who was complaining about having the largest debt in the state of 80 million, having just paid 25 million to the Places Vic for a building. So there are many councils out there, Boroondara included, that have debt, well, how long have you got? We are still in the strongest position of any council in Victoria. I know that we all went to Sydney a couple of weeks ago, and we're very jealous of their, you know, $30 million a quarter in developer contributions, and their $570 million investment portfolio, and the $55 million they get a year in commercial lease revenue. We don't compare with that, but we still are in a relatively strong position, albeit maybe not as strong as in the past. And as we come up against things like 100 million plus on the Queen Vic market, potentially an investment program on the Town Hall precinct here over the next decade, we will need to make some savings, potentially pursue some new revenue opportunities, because we're not going to be able to do everything we aspire to do with the current revenue streams that we have. So I think we do need to start paying attention to the financials, and next year's budget may be a tad more difficult than last year's budget as we talk about some of those big programs going forward. So would the seconder like to speak?
There's hardly anything left to say, thank you, Chair, except to say that this is a great tribute to our Director Mark Stormer and our CFO Fu for tracking so closely the budget to what we laid down at the start of the financial year. I must admit I got very excited when I saw that the underlying surplus was $5.6 million ahead of tracking, but in typical form, Fu has just reminded me, both verbally and at point four, that almost all of the variance is due to timing, so I can't spend that or even save it. And while I would agree with you, Chair, that there is a sale of a lane in here, I'd want to point out to some of our excitable friends in the media that we do not sell off the iconic lanes of Melbourne, that for the most part, when you go and actually look at these so-called lanes, they tend to be either complete dead ends going nowhere or now completely enclosed within a newly approved development and therefore worthless for any other purpose than sale to the owner of the general property. It is a very good, very healthy report, not least of which because it is tracking exactly where our finance and governance area told us it should be.
Any other speakers, councillors? All those in favour? Any against? Declare that carried unanimously. Agenda item 6.7 is the allocation of the discretionary fund for the first quarter of the financial year. Would councillors like a presentation? I'm happy to move the motion on the screen. Is there a seconder? No. Councillor Leppett. I think it's appropriate that the Director of City Business, Martin Cutter, would have been the person giving a presentation because Cutter by name and Cutter by nature in terms of the discretionary budget. For 2013-14, we've taken about 300k out of it, an excellent exercise in cutting, and you can see how we're going. We've still managed to spend 100,000 in the first 3 months, and we've only got 300 to play with. So, councillors, we're going to have to be a bit more disciplined in the last 9 months of the year if we're going to meet the cut budget for last-minute items, spur-of-the-moment things, missed the grants program, these sort of discretionary, confidential monies that we dish out to a wide variety of groups. And I always enjoy this item every quarter because we get to publicly disclose our confidential work as to who actually got the cash over the quarter. And when you look through it, I think it's terrific that we supported White Knight to the tune of close to $80,000 in mainly permit waivers and free banners and things like that. But you can see where we're spending the money in the report. It's good that this is publicly disclosed. It's good that there's less items this time than previously. And it's good that we've made a reasonable fist of adjusting to the Martin Cutted budget. So I think well done, councillors, in terms of showing some discipline. Thanks to the officers for cutting this program, and we do appreciate the transparency of approving it tonight.
No, let it go.
Would the seconder like to speak?
No.
Any other speakers?
I don't know if there are
any questions of the CEO. Any questions of the CEO, Councillor Leppett?
No, if there's something to contribute.
I just remind the council that they approved the budget.
That's a excellent point. Thank you for moving this, Chair, and thank you for the officers for putting it together. The policies have changed. The discretionary fund is a lot smaller than it was. That's a good thing. It reduces the number of decisions that are made on the fly and without any disclosure at the time to the public. One thing that has changed in this report, which was flagged recently, is that the in-kind contributions have now been disclosed, and I thank Martin and his team for doing that. It's important, I think, that we do disclose big decisions like that. It's not always that we're foregoing income, because often, you know, helping festivals or events advertise on our banners is done at a time when we otherwise wouldn't be making income. But it's important that we do disclose the nominal size of that gift, so that everyone is aware that that is the sort of thing that we do from time to time. And we've in kind contributed $30,000 for the waiving of fees for designing 007, the Bond exhibition. And of course, as Councillor Mayne said, a lot to White Knight. In the past, we've done the same sort of thing for many other organisations. So I think it's important that we do make that public knowledge, and that policy is actually being reviewed at the moment. And I think the best way to review any policy is to make sure that the community to which the policy applies is aware of the decisions that the council is making. So thank you to the officers for making that change.
Any other speakers? All those in favour? Any against? Declare that carried unanimously. Back to the script. Councillor Mayne states, I now call on the Lord Mayor Robert Doyle to assume the role of chair for the remainder of the meeting.
Just remind the councillor that the notes do say the bits in square brackets you don't read out, but I am delighted by his enthusiasm for nominative determinism in the role of Martin Cutter, and can only rejoice that Martin's previous partner in crime, Joe Grower, is no longer with us in that case. This does conclude the reports from management to be considered. There are two items of general business to be considered. The first is a notice of motion from Councillor Leppert on the East-West Link tender process, and I call on Councillor Leppert to move a motion with respect to this matter.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I move the motion as it appears.
Thank you. Is there a seconder for that motion? Thank you, Councillor Wood. Councillor Leppert.
Thank you again. Now, putting aside for the purposes of this debate the merits or otherwise of the project, we do have this thing called the Comprehensive Impact Statement process to deal with. The Comprehensive Impact Statement is enormous. I still haven't finished reading it, to be honest. We're now on to serious matters, Councillor Mayne. And that certainly means that the sorts of things that will arise through the public submissions and through, in fact, the process that allows us to make submissions would also be quite complicated and could be extremely significant. Now, the sorts of things that the City of Melbourne itself has been discussing about what it could put into the Comprehensive Impact Statement is very significant. The big problem here, as was articulated well in The Age recently, is that there's a huge difference, I suppose, between putting a deadline for tenders before the end of that CIS process is complete and then asking for the tenders to respond to it afterwards, than there would be to finish the CIS process first and ask the tenderers to, as they complete their tender documents, respond to all of the information that they have. Now, I do accept that the Linking Melbourne Authority argues that they'll both arrive at the same outcome, and technically I suppose that is possible. However, the perception out there in the community, as was articulated in the media in October, is that that process is the wrong way around, and therefore that process is a sham. Now, again, putting aside the merits of the project itself, and I'm certainly not trying to be an apologist for or to fight for the integrity of the CIS process per se, I do think that all of those matters that will be coming out through the CIS process, through the public submissions and through our submission, are things that should be properly publicly available, properly taken into account by not only the panel assessing the CIS submissions, but also the minister and the tender applicants themselves, the consortia, before those final documents are put together, so that the community can be assured that these things aren't just being brushed aside. I've had multiple residents tell me that why would they bother even telling council what we should be putting in our CIS submission on their behalf, because the tender deadline is before our submission is due. Our submission will be properly assessed anyway. So I think that's why we need to assist here. I think that's why a message to the Minister that there is a better way of doing this is something that the City of Melbourne, on behalf of our residents, can be doing. And as I said, I'm certainly not trying to legitimise the process or to argue here that the project has merits or otherwise, but if there are significant matters that can be that can be raised during this CIS process, and there is a chance that open space and recreation concerns and social concerns and all these various concerns can be taken into account, and that negative ramifications can be mitigated as much as possible, then we need to do everything that we can to do that. And so that is the purpose of this motion. I think it's relatively straightforward, and hopefully it has the support of the council. I commend it.
Councillor Wood.
Not too much more to add to what Councillor Abbott's had to say, but I think the point's well made that this is not about any delay or anything sort of sinister like that. It's really a process issue. And I would hope that LMA and the Victorian Government see it as such, in that really what this does is, perception is just as important as reality in many cases. There is a perception in the community that they may not be able to input into this process with the process as it currently stands. This tweaking to the process should give legitimacy to that community input. So I think LMA and Victorian Government should actually see this as a good step in the process if they're really seeking that community input.
Is there a speaker against the motion? Is there a further speaker for the motion? Councillor Watts.
I would agree with what's been said so far. It seems to be simply common sense to look at the process and see what comes first, what comes second, and where are we going with this. And currently, my understanding is that there is really no realistic opportunity for the information that flows to the CIS to be incorporated in the tender documents. The Linking Melbourne Authority reassure us that they will adjust things, or various considerations will be taken into account after the tender process has occurred. But it strikes me that, in fact, that's asking the public to make a bit of a leap of faith, and sadly, they're not prepared to do that. If any of the people who've been talking to me from our constituency are to be taken into account. So this is a very good motion, which recommends that the government take the people into account.
Is there a speaker against the motion? Is there a further speaker for the motion? Councillor Mayne.
Look, I guess the only point I'd like to add is that I think there has been indecent haste with this process ever since the new Premier decided to embrace it as his signature project. And personally, I'm amazed that having not promised to do this, in fact, having explicitly promised not to do this, that they're going helter-skelter to a ridiculous timeline to sign a massive multi-billion-dollar contract weeks before an election when they didn't have a mandate to do this. So it's probably not quite relevant to the specifics of this motion, but of course you should have a CIS before you complete a tender. And the fact that we're even having to ask for this just highlights the ridiculousness of the time frame for a massive process, for a massively rushed project. And the risk, of course, is also that under time duress, you just do a bad deal, because you've created this negotiating environment where the other party knows you're desperate to sign something. So I think as much as we can do, they're sort of out of our scope, those arguments, but I think this just points to the problem with the time frame and the scale of what's been contemplated here.
Is there further speaking of the motion? In that case, just let me add a little bit. I support this motion. I don't entirely agree with some of the sentiments and some of the motivations ascribed to the present process. We should remember that our motion is not the same thing as government action. You know, what we're going to ask them to do is to reverse the order of when consultation occurs and decision occurs. However, in these big projects, it would be remarkably naive to assume that it is an entirely linear, lockstep process. It is not. It is an iterative process. I understand, though, that the community needs to have confidence that their submissions will be listened to. And one aspect of them having faith in that would be to have the tenders let after the consultation process is finished. Nevertheless, And I would say to my fellow councillors, if you have people saying to you, oh, I'm not going to put in a submission because, you know, the tenders are let before the consultation period is over, you should say to them, maybe that's not ideal, but don't let that stop you putting in a submission. You know, don't not be heard on the basis of what you might presuppose is the case, because many of these big projects do that. Some have unhappy results, and the regional rail project is one, as I know Councillor Leppert, Councillor Oak and Councillor Wood can attest in terms of community confidence. But it is not the same thing to say that because they occur in this order, tenders being let, consultation being concluded, the consultation is not listened to. And we ourselves are arguing, remember that, we ourselves are arguing that we wish to have input to the successful tenderer during that process. So we ourselves are saying we want to have that position, thank you very much, and we do believe it is a worthwhile one. So we don't want to, you know, overblow what we are accusing the government of here. Nevertheless, it is important that there is community confidence, and if this is one thing the government can do to engender further community confidence, then they should consider doing so. And that's why I support Councillor Leppert's motion. Is there a further speaker to the motion? Would the mover like to conclude debate? In that motion, that is unanimous. Thank you. Could I move to item 7.2, notice of motion from Councillor Oak, the St. Petersburg relationship. We do have three presenters. Could I first call on Carl Catter to address the committee in relation to the matter to speak for no more than 3 minutes? Thanks, Carl. Yeah, by all means.
Thank you very much for having me today, everyone. Councillors and Mayor. Back a couple of months ago, we handed in a petition from Change.org. I'm here speaking on behalf of Change.org. We had close to about 10,000 signatures in a rather small time frame, about 4 days, because we felt time was of the essence. From what I understand, a letter was written to St. Petersburg Council to express concern, and we've received and you've received a letter back. Unfortunately, I haven't seen this letter, but it would be great to see if that is made public or possible if that can be made public. But I just want to remind people of a few issues here. It happens generally weekly now that I get people approaching me asking me what's happened. So the community out there, the Melburnians who have signed this petition, are still concerned about this issue, and they really feel that the Melbourne City Council has an opportunity to send a message. And we kind of feel that message hasn't quite been sent yet. The violence has increased substantially since that petition was handed in, because the law that was on crossing, covering the Council of St. Petersburg has now been implemented federally. There has been 2 murders, etc. And it's greatly disturbing for our community, and personally it's greatly disturbing for someone that has grown up in a regional area and understands the benefits of an accepting city such as Melbourne. And Melbourne has a great reputation, and I'm a little concerned that this reputation may be at risk. I'm the first to acknowledge, and no one will dispute the hard work that the council has done for the LGBTI community. But this is something that the community is looking for action on, and there is an opportunity to send a message. So we do ask that, can you please reconsider the suspension of this relationship? Just a little bit of a rundown of some of the things that have been happening since we last handed in the petition. Amnesty International have started watching Russia very closely. There's been many breaches of what they feel are breaches to human rights. On November the 3rd, there was a violent attack of close to 20 to 30 young youths who pretty much attacked a non-governmental organisation for the LGBTI community and addressing HIV/AIDS. 2 people there were seriously hurt. On October the 12th, the Pride rally, there were over 200 extremists, violent extremists, that attacked the parade. Many people were injured and 67 people were arrested, predominantly from the LGBTI community. As I said, there's been 2 murders. On May 13th, a 23-year-old was tortured and murdered after disclosing his sexuality. anti-gay politicians are making blatant homophobic statements now because this law has pretty much given a reason for further vilification. And
if you just wouldn't mind concluding, Carl, that'd be great.
Am I up? Okay. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, and I do ask that you reconsider the suspension of the relationship with the St. Peter's Seed.
Thanks, Carl. Could I ask Brett Hayo also to speak? Brett, I'm making a stab at pronunciation of your surname. I hope I didn't mangle it horribly.
Not at all, Your Worship. Your Worship and all members of the committee, I'm Brett Hayhoe, Secretary of Interpride, the International Association of Pride Organisers, as well as both the World Pride and Communications Committee co-chair of that organisation. International action against such human rights breaches is not a new revelation. In 2006, in response to well-documented patterns of abuse, a distinguished group of international human rights experts met in Yogyakarta in Indonesia to outline a set of international principles relating specifically to sexual orientation and gender identity. The 29 Yogyakarta principles include the right to the universal enjoyment of human rights, the rights to equality and non-discrimination, the right to life, the right to freedom from torture and cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment, the right to freedom of opinion and expression, the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association, the right to freedom of movement, the right to participate in public life, the right to participate in cultural life, the right to promote human rights and accountability. Clearly, the legislation currently in Russia breaches all of these in disgusting abundance. Furthermore, Interpride in 2012 released a statement denouncing the propaganda laws in no uncertain terms. In part, it said Interpride is deeply opposed to and condemns the shameful law adopted in St. Petersburg, which clearly constitutes a violation of Russia's international obligation to uphold human rights, freedom of expression, and the fight against discrimination. The legislation endangers all LGBTI people in Russia and violates the right to hold a public event, publish articles, or even discuss issues regarding LGBTI people. The legislation will have a catastrophically detrimental effect on the LGBTI movement and individuals in Russia. This, ladies and gentlemen, it has done in violent abundance. So I implore the Melbourne City Council to not be a silent observer, but rather a responsible, active participant of change. Council must immediately suspend its sister city relationship with St. Petersburg until action by the Russians to right the wrongs of this legislation are instigated once and for all. I trust the custodians of this city that I love will, without any further delay, show their true rainbow colours and send a definitive message of intolerance to such human rights violations. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Brett. Very elegant imagery, if I may say. Rainbow colours. Could I call now on Corey Earlham, who also asked if he could speak to us? Thanks, Corey.
You'll have a presentation pack from me. There's some history and background. I'm going to start here by the point of saying that the VGLRL works with people on the grounds internationally. We don't say to you, this is what we think. We ask them, what do they think? And that's a really important thing. I'd also say this is something that is about diplomacy. It's not about sensationalism in the media because that causes backlash. We're not here to say to you to cancel your cultural relationship with St. Petersburg. We're here to say suspend it and take a stance. Can I have the next slide, please? So what's happening on the ground in Russia? Well, pride flags banned because it's propaganda. We have gay and lesbian people being hunted via social media by what's labelled as neo-Nazism, it's just people who don't like them. They are then videotaped in embarrassing positions, some of them sexual. They are then bashed, this is recorded, and this is promoted onto social media in videos and images. Interestingly, one of the images that I gave you tonight had to be censored by the City of Melbourne because it said the F word, yet this is the sort of things that people are subjected to. Some of those victims have died from their injuries. Some of them committed suicide for fear of it happening. We talked about earlier pride marches being banned and participants being arrested by the police because it's seen as propaganda. Because a child may see a pride march. They may see a pride flag. This is propaganda. I don't understand how. The basis of this is, as people who challenge and defend these laws are saying that gays are pedophiles. This is something that Australia dealt with 20 years ago, and yet we're still taking a stance and saying it's okay. We arrested last week a Russian editor for printing the words, and I quote, this was by a quote from a school teacher, "My very existence is proof being gay is normal." Because those words were printed in a newspaper, a child could see it, the editor was arrested. Lady Gaga was fined 20,000 rupees for mentioning the word gay on stage. Can I have the next slide, please? Let's put this in very simple terms, ladies and gentlemen. These homophobic laws of St. Petersburg and Russia are being utilised as a pretense for calling gays pedophiles and unnatural. It creates a culture of state-sanctioned permission for violence against LGBTI people, and the police are doing very little to enforce laws protecting people. And Melbourne City Council is endorsing this. The Lord Mayor just said earlier as I walked in that the standard you walk by is the standard that you accept. All we're asking is that the City of Melbourne doesn't walk past this atrocity. Next slide, please. Very briefly, there are Russian laws. However, the St. Petersburg law does have an impact on local police. Next slide, please. And finally, what are we recommending? Suspend the city-city relationship. Seek assurances the Russian police are investigating, pursuing the people who are persecuting these crimes. Seek written explanation of what is propaganda in the presence of children. Do not fund a St. Petersburg representative to come here and engage with the Russian people on this. Final slide will give you my details. Happy to talk.
Thank you very much. I think a couple of our councillors would like to ask some questions, if that's okay. Councillor Oak.
Sorry, Corey, actually, because I received your slides earlier, and thanks. I was interested in your, I'm not sure if we could put the presentation back up, but it was, I think it was the do not fund a St. Petersburg person.
Could you second last slide.
On the final slide.
There was some media reports that there was talk of City of Melbourne funding representatives from St. Petersburg to come here. There was also information provided to people who called into City of Melbourne saying that was being considered. We're saying don't do it.
And what, in particular, if it was in reference, I think it was in reference to maybe someone from that particular, from the LGBTI community, is that what you're referring to?
So if you're going to spend council money, don't reward the people who are doing the bad behaviour. No. Come and listen to the people who are being affected by this. So if you're going to bring anybody out, bring somebody who's being persecuted. Hear what's going on the ground.
I think that was the situation.
Yeah, I'm sorry to clear that up. Let me make that clear too. That was our intention, but our advice was, and I thought that was the advice from you guys, don't do it because such a person may face sanctions when they return home.
We can talk to you quietly about how to do it without doing public splash on it. I would say it's not an open meeting of having the media all here and having that person's face passed around.
Okay. Any further questions? Thanks, Corey.
Thanks.
Could I call on Councillor Oak to move a motion with respect to this matter?
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I move the recommendation. Sorry, move the motion on the screen.
Thank you. Is there a seconder for that? Thank you, Councillor Leppert. Councillor Oak.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Obviously, I'd like to firstly acknowledge the presenters tonight, and in particular, Carl Catter, who did present the Lord Mayor and Councillor Mayne and myself the original petition in May, was it? In March. So it was a long time ago, and as Carl quite rightly points out, it was a very short period of time that you gathered those signatures, and my understanding is actually after the effect there was a lot more, there are a lot more signatures on your petition for us to suspend our sister city relationship. So thank you for presenting tonight, and I think the presentations are important for councillors and people in the gallery to understand why this notice of motion has been put forward, that there is serious discrimination, there are serious hate laws being perpetrated in our sister city, and as has been pointed out now across Russia, and it's something that we shouldn't stand by and do nothing about. We should try as a leader. The City of Melbourne likes to think it's a leader in many areas, and we should use that leadership role to make a difference, whatever that difference may be. and the motion before us is not about making a decision about how we do that tonight, and it is an annoying, another bureaucratic step in the way. But I think that it's important that we gather as much information as we can about the two alternative approaches that we have in front of us. We could either suspend the sister-city relationship, as many cities have done, and send a message that way, or as another submitter to tonight's meeting. We should acknowledge that the Director of Corpus Medicorum, Dr. Philip, is it Antipa?
Antipa
has presented a submission to us as he's about to go on a tour to St. Petersburg with the orchestra, and he argues that these sort of relationships and these sort of trips are a way of representing Melbourne and the tolerant and diverse city that we do hold dearly. And so there are two different approaches in front of us, and I think that we need more information. I don't think we shouldn't spend any more time, making a decision about suspending the relationship or using the sister city relationship avenues in front of us. We shouldn't spend any more time than the 17th of December that is in front of us. And I hope that we make a decision at that council meeting. This motion effectively is asking for a report about what we can do within the sister city relationship that we have. It's also calling for information from management basically makes us aware of our options around suspension or using the relationships that are contained in that report. I guess from my point of view, I think Carl mentioned that in your presentation, that Melbourne is a diverse and tolerant city. We do support and celebrate our queer culture, and the Queer Film Festival won a Melbourne Award on Saturday night, and I think it was one of the best speeches and presentations on the night. And Midsummer is obviously something that we've supported from its inception. We also support, quite importantly, it's not about just supporting the culture, it's supporting the people within the community, and we do provide significant funds, quite rightly, to support services for members of the community that are facing discrimination in this city, but also issues around their coming out to their families or how they work within their community. And it's important that we do that as a city. So it's important that we take this seriously, that we listen to the calls that are coming to us to make a stand. It's important for us to make a decision about how we influence our sister city, and whether that is suspension or whether that's using the relationships in front of us, we have to make that decision. But I personally, my personal opinion right now is that I can't see how we can sit by and watch or a sister city perpetrate laws, as has been described by our presenters and as we've seen in the media on not a daily basis in Melbourne, but we do see it regularly even in the mainstream press here. And suspension is something that we should seriously consider.
Thank you. Councillor Leppard.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Thank you to Councillor Oak for putting this motion forward. It's obviously a very significant issue, and something that we've had more feedback from our community on than pretty much anything else so far in this term. A couple of exceptions perhaps, but it's right up there. Another one of our sister cities, in fact, Milan, has suspended its relationship with St. Petersburg until St. Petersburg revokes the anti-gay legislation that it has in place. Carl, I think, mentioned that since the petition was tabled at council, obviously the situation isn't getting better. There's been more violence and the legitimisation of violence, the legitimisation of discrimination that these laws facilitate has only seen the situation getting worse. So on the one hand, whilst the suspension of a sister city relationship isn't going to affect the change overnight, and certainly many of St. Petersburg's sister cities have suspended that relationship in disgust, it is one thing that we can do. We've got very little in our power here in Melbourne, but it is one thing that we can do to send the message that this is not right, to expose the atrocities that are happening, and to let the world know that, and so that the world can send a message that this is not okay. However, there are two options up there, and I think both are probably better than nothing else. I really don't think that there is a third option. You know, going quiet and letting the sister city relationship sort of just be there on paper and not really do much with it. I really don't think that's an option. Obviously, our community is very, very concerned about what's happening in St. Petersburg and the legal legitimisation of what's happening in St. Petersburg, and so there is no third option. I would be very interested to see the report that comes from management to the 17th of December meeting. I'm aware of a few things that the City of Melbourne does with St. Petersburg and have a few theories about ways in which the City of Melbourne can be a little bit more political in that relationship and be a little bit smarter in you know, pulling the few levers that we have to affect change, even if these are very, very small things. We do need to take this seriously and putting up there in this motion now that the City of Melbourne is actively considering the suspension, even though we're making no such decision today, all we're doing is commissioning a report, I think is also in itself a very important step to sending the right message. I think the suggestions made at the end of the VGLRL presentation were excellent. It's the sort of thing that we'll discuss again on the 17th of December, no doubt. I don't want to preempt that debate in any way, but I do note the seriousness with which our constituents are taking this issue, and thank the submitters, thank the presenters, and thank fellow councillors for also taking it so seriously this evening.
Is there a speaker against the motion? Is there a further speaker for the motion? Councillor Wood.
Just briefly, obviously my forte isn't international relations, so I think this is a good motion in that it doesn't presuppose how we might deal with this situation, because really what we're looking for is an outcome. I didn't understand the extent to what's going on in terms of the violence, but I don't think we need to see that violence to realise laws like this aren't the sort of thing that we would support in any way, shape or form. I don't understand persecuting someone because of their sexuality or their gender or their race, so it's a difficult thing to see this sort of thing going on. I will make the point, and I think you all made it pretty well in terms of your submissions, that City of Melbourne absolutely prides itself on the acceptance that we have for all members of our community. This is really an interesting situation that we're in, where we've got a sister city relationship with a town which seems pretty much set on, I don't even know if you call it rolling back laws into the dark ages, but it's a pretty amazing set of circumstances. So I commend Councillor Oak for bringing this motion forward, and I look forward to seeing how we might get to the outcome that we desire, not presupposing how we might get to that outcome.
Is there a speaker against the motion? Further speaker for? Councillor Watts.
I support the motion, obviously. But I would comment that I'm not sure how a motion such as this actually reaches those we want to. If we want to send a warning, or we want to alert St. Petersburg that we're considering this important action, how are we to know? And I'll be interested to know. I understand. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the gentleman's title. When you the one who's No, you know, yes, who knows about public relations, who knows about advancing these things. It seems to me that our motion will gain strength as long as it reaches those we want to have, hear it and see it. And I don't personally understand how that might occur, but let's hope it does.
I can certainly use...
We don't take it, but you can speak later. Is there a further speaker to the motion? Councillor Mayne.
Councillors, is this a good motion? The two-stage process will elevate it in the public discussion rather than just coming in and going bang. I think we shouldn't be afraid to speak truth to power. We are one of the most tolerant cities in the world. The Italians have already shown how it's done. I think it's pretty clear which way we need to go. And I'm just a little bit nervous about putting the officers into the hot seat of having to produce a report and go through all the different options and mechanics of it. It's a political decision, and we need to be brave and take a stand. So I hope that we can get to that point before the end of the year.
Thank you. Councillor Wong.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I just want to say a few things because I actually had to leave for another appointment. I support this, and I thank Councillor Oak and Councillor Leppard for bringing it together, because we are in the 21st century. The City of Melbourne is a very tolerant city. Some of you may know I've run on twice on gay tickets to get elected to the City of Melbourne. Even though I'm not gay, I've got plenty of friends who are. And I think in the 21st century, what we see in Russia and under Putin and the rest, I just can't believe what's going on. I just shake my head, and I hope that when we get a report on December the 17th, it will give us a very clear indication which way we should go. Personally, I think we should just take the hard decision and make it.
Thank you. Are there any other speakers to the motion? In that case, I'll also have a dash at this. I'm reluctant to trivialise this debate, but as Councillor Wong made his startling revelation, I was reminded of the great Frank Thring, who, when he asked that question, did say to the young man in question, "We'll have a Bacardi and Coke and think about it." And I've always enjoyed that from Frank. I want to thank our submitters and just echo that I support your abhorrence for these particular laws, personally and professionally, and I do so utterly. What I ask myself is how best to support your concerns, and that's what this motion puts before us. And I do not think it is as simple as some councillors have put tonight. We've been exhorted not to be a silent observer, and I think Councillor Leppett very eloquently indicated that that is not possible for us. We need to take one or other of the courses put before us. I don't echo Councillor Main's concerns because I do want to explore what the options are for us to actually do before we pull that final trigger. And I'll come back to that in a moment, because don't presume it's a halfway house. It is a final trigger. And we may be prepared to do it, but we should be exploring other things first. So in thinking for me, what is it we want to do? And I think it's pretty basic, isn't it? We want to protest against these laws because we do find them abhorrent. But we want to go beyond that. And everyone talks about how do we influence these laws? How do we aim for them to be repealed? How do we aim for people not to be discriminated against? And the question for me is, what is the best methodology for that? Is it a methodology of disengagement, suspending our relationship with St. Petersburg? Or is it a policy of further engagement, seeking to take part in a conversation with them while they'll remain in a conversation to continue to express what we feel? I would just make this point. Much has been made of Milan as our sister city and other sister cities of St. Petersburg, although not ours, suspending their relationship. Though a point I would make is, all of the abhorrence that you have described has occurred after they have taken that step. So in fact, those cities taking that step has had no effect on what we find abhorrent. And my concern is not for us here and how we feel, but for those people in St. Petersburg who are suffering under this regime. And therefore, I'm not entirely persuaded by the efficacy of suspension. I'll make the point about pulling that trigger now. Please don't presume that although we use the word suspend the relationship, that St. Petersburg would then say at some future time, "Oh, please, welcome us back." My view of the world is that if we say we're going to suspend it, that is the end of the relationship, because they will simply not re-enter into it. It is the termination of the relationship, not merely its suspension. And that offers me concern because it means they no longer have to listen to us. They no longer have to take our delegations. In fact, they can block them. They no longer have to treat us as people who need to be listened to, not for us, but for the sake of their international reputation. And I think that's the biggest lever that we have, their international reputation as a city. So I come back to that idea, which is the best methodology by which we can protest and influence? Is it disengagement or engagement? And I don't feel yet that we have fully explored all of the avenues of engagement. That's why, for me, I think that this is an excellent motion. I think it does give us the chance to pause and think about what more we might be prepared to do. I think to answer Councillor Watts's question, we don't need to do this. These things are very closely watched and all of the nuances are analysed. And I can assure you that will be done. I note, Corey, in your submission from VGLRL that you asked if you could meet me, and the answer is, of course, you know, I'd be delighted to meet with you and sit down privately, as I have with Carl and with a number of other groups. I'd be delighted to do it. I would have to say at the moment for me, and this might not be a popular thing because you've each asked us passionately to go immediately to suspending the relationship, I am not yet persuaded by that. I'm not yet persuaded that there aren't further levers in engagement that we can use in order to both protest and influence. That may be a disagreement that we have about the way we approach it, but I would want to emphasise to you that you need be under no illusions about the support that I have personally for your abhorrence for these laws and my commitment to working with you to seeing what we can do to both protest and influence. And thank you again for your submissions tonight. Is there a further contributor debate? Councillor Oak, would you like to conclude?
Oh, just briefly, Lord Mayor, and acknowledge and thank my colleagues for all of their presentations, and I think collectively we've summed up what the motion before us is all about, that we have collectively we're appalled by the anti-gay laws and the hate crimes that are occurring in St. Petersburg, and you've hopefully heard that loud and clear. But we also collectively want to make a difference and do what we can as the City of Melbourne. But we haven't yet worked out what that is, and I think we need more information. And your presentations tonight have helped us greatly, and thank you for that. But I believe that the report describing exactly how a relationship works and how we can use some of those levers in a better way, as the Lord Mayor, I think, has articulated incredibly well, I think that is something that we need to explore further, and why, whilst we may have had, we might have discussed suspension tonight, I don't think that would have been appropriate, because we do need that extra detail about how we could use the relationship further. And so I thank colleagues for their contributions, and I thank in advance the officers for preparing a report, and I guess point out that we're not asking officers to provide an opinion. We're not asking officers to provide their recommendation. We're asking officers just to provide a report on the sister city relationship. We're asking officers to provide the mechanism at which we could do either one or two, but not to actually provide commentary or to indicate which way they would suggest we would go, just to make sure that is made clear. And if officers need to discuss that further, please do, because I don't want to put you in an awkward position.
Thank you, Lord Councillor. I'll now put the motion. All those in favour? That is carried unanimously. Thank you. You can indeed, Councillor. Are there any items of proposed urgent business? In that case, we also provide a 15-minute period at the end of our meetings for members of the public to ask questions, and the same rules apply. Questions should not be greater than 90 seconds in duration. Yes?
From here?
Oh, no, please, up there. Yeah.
Can I start with an apology? I apologise, particularly to the last three speakers, to bring us back from what is a fundamentally moral issue to one which must seem quite parochial, listened to all that. But
we're used to that. I promise you we're used to that.
I just wanted to clarify in my own mind, because I have to go back and talk to the residents in Yarra's Edge, that my understanding is the position of this committee is that they support the bridge between the two points, but they would like the bridge to be thought about in terms of making better access for the marina, and that you're not necessarily taking on board all the other issues. Maybe rethinking the whole concept of the bridge. Because the wording that I saw behind me, and maybe you can put it back up again, was that you're recommending that we look at that there is a revision of the design of the bridge. That to me seems to say that the bridge is okay. Am I misinterpreting this?
I'll give Councillor Wood a crack first. Yep, as the mover.
That's not it at all. Essentially what we're saying is this is a submission to a Place of Victoria design guideline, if you like. So there's still a long way to go. What we do say is public transport connection to these areas is vital. How that looks is not something that we're predetermining or recommending. At the moment, the recommendation in the design is such that they've got a link across there. And what we're saying is that if that link were to proceed, that it can't actually impact on the marina or access into the Yarra. So we're not presupposing any impacts on open space, and all those sorts of other details that you speak of are part of the submission. So the submission's much, much wider than that.
Would it be appropriate, therefore, to add some wording to that effect, that this committee recommends that the concept of the bridge over the...
It's in the submission already. This was making explicit your absolute primary concern. So please don't presuppose that this concern trumps all other concerns. It was simply pulling out your greatest concern and making that much more explicit.
Thank you.
And look, the other point I would add is, I know our wording sometimes looks difficult or doesn't go as far as you would like. That's part of where we are in the process, very early. But I think what we tried to do here, and I think hence the unanimity of acceptance of this, was to say we actually concur with the submissions that were put before us. We don't think this is workable, and we hope that this is the start of the process where we can make it workable and take into account the concerns of the submitters who put their letters before us.
Thanks for the clarification.
I'm sorry you had to wait. I'm sorry our rules sometimes don't help there. We should have actually allowed you to do that at the start by having a number of questions in a row, but that's the fault of your unworthy chairman, I'm sorry. But thank you for your patience in waiting. Are there any further questions? Yeah, of course. Thank you, Corey.
Won't be able to present to you 17th of December. A couple of quick things. Cape Town and South Africa took people back after sanctions over apartheid, including hosting the World Cup.
Corey, it's for questions. It's
I'm getting to
for
a question.
Further. Yeah, yeah.
So I understand that. In the context of understanding that this is now a national issue in Russia because there are national laws and therefore potentially the actions of the Melbourne City Council won't actually affect those people on the ground, the question that you will need to answer for the Melbourne community is how many cultural trips are worth a life?
Can I thank members of the public and the management for their interest and attendance and declare the meeting closed at 7:24.